Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. This is our weekly investing power hour. I'm Ryan Henderson, your co-host, joined by Brett Schaefer, as always. We are talking all things investing this week. There's some news in the week. It's officially earnings season, so we can certainly talk through some of those. And I'm sure Brett came prepared with a couple news stories as well. As always, if you are listening to this on our podcast player, on your podcast player, we do these shows live on YouTube at Thursdays at 9:30 Pacific time, 12:30 Eastern time, and you can ask questions there. So we're going to take questions from the audience today as normal. But before we get into things, Brett, it's earnings season, busy time. How are you feeling?
Good. Feeling good. It's exciting. Luckily for someone that doesn't own a ton of stocks, it's more of a entertaining time or just kind of perusing some various earnings reports I'm interested in. And the few stocks I actually own, you know, it's not that stressful. This is when it's much more fun to not own 50 stocks as opposed to just 10 or fewer. I thought,
of course, a little tough.
As always, the Tesla earnings were fascinating, as they like to make them out to be, always. Chipotle was a little interesting, although that's kind of a boring, in some regards, where it's the same formula every quarter. It's just kind of dependent on what investors are going to react to. And I didn't know, even though I should have known since it's on my watch list, but I will say I was under the weather this week, so I'll use that as an excuse. The one of our favorite fintech companies, Adyen, reported, and stock's down. So we had someone suggest that we go through that, and I haven't looked at the earnings report, so we could probably go through that live during the show. So I think I'm excited to do that as well. And oh, one thing I read this week, there was a great report in the Wall Street Journal on the Chinese real estate market and how the bubble got so big, and found some interesting quotes there on how they ran a little bit of the Enron playbook at some of these companies.
Yeah, that, all right. Well, I look forward to that story. But before we get into things, we want to talk about our friends, Public Options Traders. Listen up. I want to tell you a bit about public.com. But first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you are paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms also charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or per contract fees, and in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 option contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. To recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for options trading and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded only at public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. NerdWallet overall rating 4.6 out of 5 as of April 2024. Full disclosures in the podcast description, US members only. Let's get right into earnings season. I think that's a fun place to start. We could call this the earnings palooza episode, or maybe we can think of something a little sexier to attract some listeners. But you want to start with Tesla, or were there any reports? How about this? Were there any reports that have actually stood out to you?
I don't know if there's any that stood out. It's still pretty early, I guess. The reaction to Tesla was probably the one that stood out the most, because the numbers looked bad and maybe a little worse than people were expecting. Like, the expectation was that they were going to be bad, and, you know, the numbers were pretty bad, but there was this, I guess, they're very good at telling their story. So they hyped up a lot of the future products and people got excited about that. And I was surprised to see the stock so much up so much on that react or, you know, on that report. The reaction was quite positive and I really thought it was going to be negative. But yeah, besides that, not really. Again, I've been kind of sick, so I haven't read every report. Maybe we'll look at Adyen and I'll be surprised at that and think it could be a buying opportunity. But yeah. What about you?
No, I read some of the snippets of the Tesla conference call, which, I mean, whenever Elon is on there saying something big's about to happen in either this year, but maybe next year, certainly no more than 2 years, then you know they or it's pumping season. And so
yeah.
There was a quote in the conference call. They were talking about, he was talking about how one's full self-driving without any assistance from a driver. And he's been saying this for a while, obviously. Once it gets approved, it'll be the biggest value unlock in like corporate American history. And, you know, maybe there's some truth to that, because if you can license it to other OEMs, that's obviously just a huge profit driver. But he said, I wouldn't be surprised if we do sign a deal. I think we have a good chance we do sign a deal this year, maybe more than 1 year. But yes, it would probably be 3 years before it's integrated with a car. So he's talking about licensing full self-driving to other OEMs. Now, the timeline on this, I think he said something similar in 2016.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's the reality here? I think this is like textbook Elon. But it works. It works. I didn't think the numbers were very good. I can go through some of them now, but automotive gross profit just continues to decline. Let's see here. Total gross profit. Let's get to the year over year change. Sorry, I know you guys can hear me clicking around here. So year over year total gross profit was, or let's do automotive, -24% year over year on the automotive gross profit. So that's really the big driver for the business here. Make no mistake about it. And gross profit, I think they maybe take some cost of goods sold and put it into general and administrative. So they kind of juice the gross margins a little bit, would be my guess, or maybe it's not the gross margin, sorry, the adjusted margins. Adjusted EBITDA has been getting really close to gross profit margins, which I find kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, just ignore that number.
Yeah. But how much of this do you think is Tesla specific versus just electric vehicle demand has declined?
Well, if you look at some of the startups, they're struggling as well. Rivian seems to have hit a wall, although we'll see what happens with them this quarter. But if you look at some of the legacy players, they're doing fine because they have ICE vehicles, hybrids, and electric vehicles. You see someone like Toyota doing fine. General Motors, I think, just reported better margins than Tesla from a bottom line perspective, or at least EBIT margins. We just had a comment here. BYD and GM had positive EV sales. So I think it's a little bit industry-wide and a little bit Tesla-specific, especially because they're coming out of their core market. You know, they dominated the West Coast and California for so long, and I think going to other areas is tougher. Plus, the Cybertruck, I don't know if it's definitive yet, but I would call it maybe 50% of the way to a flop so far. No one seems to be buying it. When they did that recall of the entire vehicle fleet of Cybertrucks, and they admitted that there was less than 4,000 on the road, I think that shows there's not very much demand there, even though there's videos out there of people driving them. So we'll see. And that seems to have terrible unit economics, given that it's built out of stainless steel. And I mean, that whole thing is an engineering debacle. But
yeah,
you know,
I saw one on the road, and I was I don't know. It's a little smaller than I thought. Like, you kind of picture him being this big truck, and it just wasn't. I didn't realize how low it was. It wasn't as pretty on the eye as I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible car, but and it's never going to make money because of the design flaws. Like, you're making it out of stainless steel and with sharp edges. It breaks every rule of the design flaw of car design. But I guess it's going to come down to their next vehicle, which could be out in a year, two, three, or something like that. And they're betting all this stuff on, okay, we're actually an AI and robotics company. We're spending $1 billion on AI CapEx. I thought it was really funny reading the earnings slides when they had their Dojo supercomputer, which I gotta say is a good name for a supercomputer. That's not a bad nickname for it. They showed like a picture of it, and they had to, since they use so many renderings in their corporate history, they had to specifically say that it's not a rendering because it looks so like futuristic or something like that, which I thought was quite funny. But I mean, they're saying they're spending $1 billion on AI CapEx. They're talking about this humanoid robot. They're talking about the AI chips, which may be part of AI CapEx. They're talking about robo taxis. I mean, we have these questions here. Do you think robo taxis are going to work? Do you think Uber and Lyft handle robo taxis? Is there a critical mass component to self-driving once there's a 30% zero accident self-driving cars, makes them safer than, you know, human drivers? I mean, these are a lot of ifs. Like, none of this stuff's been solved yet. I mean, Uber would probably struggle a bit if there was a full self-driving service and they couldn't, you know, it hurts their competitive positioning a little bit, but nah, I don't know.
Nah, I would worry. Okay, there's a lot of reasons I think I would worry if I were a shareholder, and obviously with the Tesla shareholder base, a lot of them are quite fanatic about the company, so they don't really have the intention to sell anyways. But yeah, I'd be pretty concerned about the earnings power going forward. It feels like competition has begun to... We were talking about competition being a concern 3 years ago, and now it feels like it's starting to eat away at the market just because there really are so many options, and we're seeing that in the results of the big OEMs. So I guess we'll see. But yeah, I don't think the Cybertruck will be a real profit driver for this business. And a lot of those big value unlocks, robotaxi, full self-driving, if they ever come, it's not going to be for a while. But yeah, I'd be a little worried about the earnings power of this business for the next couple of years. Let's hit some okay, go ahead.
Yeah, to close things out, I would say that Tesla and Musk, they have made mistakes in the past. I mean, look at the solar roof tile. There's a lot to criticize them about, but they have pulled the rabbit out of the hat a lot. And I think if you're buying it today or holding it today, you're betting on that happening again. That's not how I invest, but hey, it's worked out in the past. I don't think it's going to work out in the future, but they pulled off miracles before, and they might be able to do it again.
True. All right. I want to talk about, I think, O'Reilly Automotive.
Oh, wow. Everyone's probably... I'm a shareholder now.
Yeah, I'm sure people are dying to listen to this. I'm a shareholder. I think it's a really solid business. We've talked about the economies of scale in this industry on the show before for them and AutoZone. They reported earnings, and I guess there was nothing that eventful, but I will say I bought, and a day later the stock was down 7%, so that was a real bummer. But this is one where it kind of gives me so much comfort in the fact that when you have a company who is really committed to a buyback program and returning capital to shareholders that way, like, and it's a company that tends to trade at a reasonable valuation, it's I take solace in any sort of stock declines because I know not only can I add some, but also I know the CEOs are buying back shares as well, or the whatever, the CFO department, if you want to call it that. So nice little drop in O'Reilly today, but there really is not anything that sexy to talk about for the business. The only thing I say is this idea that the transition to EVs is going to ruin O'Reilly's moat or O'Reilly's growth opportunities, it just doesn't seem to be materializing. And we're actually seeing, like, you know, we've been talking about with Tesla and some of the other OEMs, the demand for electric vehicles is starting to decline a bit. Maybe that's just a short-term issue, but it feels like O'Reilly, AutoZone, those businesses will be in a solid place for well north of a decade, probably another 2 decades.
Yeah, I wonder how. Yeah, like a lot of people are still buying hybrids. I'm sure those still need work. Yeah. I mean, is it just kind of steady as it goes? No concerns, just
3.5% comp stock. Sales.
What?
I think it looks pretty similar for that business all the time. It's like 3-5% comp sales. Maybe you'll have the odd year where it's a little more than that. They expand their store count. Basically, it's probably around 1-2% a year, but they add around 200 stores a year, and it's always like top line 3-5%, gross margin ticked up just marginally, and earnings were up whatever 8%, 9%, and earnings per share were up like 12% because you're getting the buyback as well. So it's always kind of nice to see. And it was one of those where I feel like I own so many businesses where I'm kind of not fretting, but I'm concerned going into like the earnings report. And I'm thinking like, what's this going to look like? Am I going to finally see the turnaround that I'm looking for or something like that? And with O'Reilly, you know what you're getting. And even if the stock drops, you have, like I said, some comfort in the fact that it doesn't change the overall outlook of the business. It's very much just like a time, I don't want to say time arbitrage, but it's a difference in people's time horizons. Like a lot of the people that are selling it off because it was whatever, 0.5% below the comp sales estimate, it seems like that's mostly short-term oriented. And for anyone that's a long-term shareholder, you know what you're getting, and it's easy to buy on drops. You don't have to think about it as much.
Yeah, it seems like a hard place to lose money. Good yeah. way to just compound at a solid rate over the long term. It could easily be a never sell position. It's probably never going to get overvalued.
True. I have found that it's fun to own businesses where you don't dread listening to the management on conference calls. So I'm looking forward to that for the future with O'Reilly.
They're super plain, right? Just, yeah, exactly how you'd imagine an auto parts retailer.
Yeah, exactly. And
yeah, they're not talking about AI capex.
No. Gosh. Yeah, that's another one we could talk about. Meta. Oh man. Mark Zuckerberg just toys with investors.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to care about like how they feel in the short run, which has worked out, but yeah.
He's like, here has been the 3-year history for Meta. We're investing everything behind the metaverse. We don't care about losses in the short term. Okay, stock sells off. What was it? 70, 80%. People are like, who knows where the spending goes? And then Zuckerberg spends like one conference call being like, well, obviously we're not going to spend an absurd amount. We want operating income to grow. All of a sudden the stock is up fivefold. And he's like, oh, you know what? Maybe we can start to juice CapEx again. And actually, we're going to layer on some AI capex as well, because we have Llama 3 now, which is our Meta AI. But it is mind blowing how much capex they are putting into this business for such a capital light business.
Yeah. Well,
is it $40 billion? I mean, it is. Well,
It's not
the businesses that drive the results of Meta are capitalized.
Well, not anymore. It's changed. The game's changed.
How?
TikTok changed it.
What do you mean?
Because it requires AI CapEx spend.
Sure.
I mean, if that's the only reason they caught up, and that's the only reason they caught up to TikTok.
It, even with that, the spend on AI infrastructure, really, it's still pretty capital light relative to most businesses in the world.
Somewhat. I mean they're going to spend more on CapEx than I think Microsoft and Google this year. And they don't have a cloud division.
They have an internal cloud division, which is a lot of data.
That's capital intensive. Yeah.
I guess, but relative to what they're earning on Facebook Blue and Instagram. Instagram, I did not realize.
Well, that's where the CapEx spend is. That's where the AI spend is going. To the algorithms for Big Blue and Instagram.
Yeah, I'll be curious what the return is on that AI spend. But
they didn't want to do that, but TikTok kind of forced their hand.
Well, maybe TikTok no more here. It appears because it's been signed or supported, right, by the president of the United States now. So I'm not sure what the process is really like there. I assume there will be some sort of appeal process that goes on for a while, but it feels like this has the backing of pretty much all the important people, all the important organizations in America. Without TikTok, who's the biggest beneficiary?
Probably first Instagram, then YouTube. Pretty simple. Then yeah, maybe Snapchat, but it's hard to really bet on them. I think it's definitely YouTube and Instagram, because what's interesting is TikTok forced a few things. First, it forced these companies to really invest in the AI algorithms that were, you know, that the good AI algorithm, what do you think, for society or not, it's what drove people, you know, if it's good for society or not, that's a different question, but it drove usage over to TikTok. They had to invest in that, as opposed to, you know, YouTube just searching for videos and kind of filtering it yourself. They worked on that recommendation algorithm, especially with YouTube Shorts. Instagram, instead of it just being your social feed, they turned it into a whole video AI service, very similar to TikTok. And what's happened there is I think it's kind of converged a lot of these social platforms into just video watching services. And I think TikTok, which did, I believe I read, about $6 to $7 billion in advertising revenue in the US last year, growing at a really healthy rate. I think that mostly goes, it has to go to YouTube and Instagram, right?
Yeah. Who do you think generates more revenue, Instagram or YouTube? Ad revenue.
No, it's Instagram, easy.
Well, it's pretty close, but yeah. It's very close, actually, or it was in 2021. But Instagram's revenue was disclosed as a part of this FTC suit, like, a couple weeks ago. And unless you... Obviously, YouTube shares most of its revenue, but Instagram was slightly larger. I was surprised by that. I thought YouTube might have been a bigger advertising platform.
I think Instagram's a lot higher. It's much better for e-commerce, like top of funnel.
Higher CPM.
Because you go to YouTube to watch, you go to Instagram to browse, kind of deal.
Yeah, I could see that. I imagine.
Except they have been converging because of this TikTok stuff.
Yeah. If you layer on YouTube premium revenue, I wouldn't be surprised if YouTube is larger. But
maybe,
YouTube
TV, or YouTube
kind of
TV.
Just about that.
All of YouTube stuff. And I think YouTube didn't set up
give the Instagram doesn't have any business where it's sharing ad revenue, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not sharing it with the creators.
Yeah, which on the one hand is kind of amazing that they're able to do that from a business model perspective, but on the other hand, I think YouTube has set itself up with a much better, you know, long-term outlook for business durability. Like, we don't even make very much money on YouTube, but it would be hard for us to leave, I think, just because, one, you have the chance to grow your audience so much, and two, it's a seamless way to make some money.
What do you think, because I was working on a content piece for this, so I'm curious on your thoughts. What do you think is the best business in big tech? You have to strip out, like, NVIDIA doesn't count. It's kind of, you know, it's not really like a, I'm talking about the best subsidiary.
Yeah, I got no takes on NVIDIA either.
Between Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Meta, if you could pull one subsidiary out of those, what would you take?
At this point in time, it depends on price, I guess. What do you think? You mean just highest quality, like highest durability?
Yeah, you're paying 10 times earnings for any of them.
For all of them, yeah, for durability and growth. If we're paying 10 times earnings, assuming normalized earnings, I'd probably either say YouTube, just because I think monetization still has a long, long way to go. I think somewhat Instagram is more, they increase monetization a lot more, because if you look at advertising on YouTube, it's still quite low on an ad load. Even though people start complaining about that, it's still like, what, one every 10, 15 minutes, honestly. I'm trying to go through in my head. I mean, LinkedIn's honestly not bad given the numbers, but I'm not sure how large that business could get, and I'm not sure how durable it is. I'm trying to go through all these subsidiaries. Google Cloud too, honestly.
Let me give
even
you some
assuming
of
normalized earnings.
Let me give you some options here. LinkedIn, Microsoft Office, Azure, Android, GCP, AWS, Amazon Prime, Amazon Advertising, WhatsApp.
Wow, that's good. That's a low starting base.
Yeah, there's high upside there, I guess. Instagram, Facebook Blue, the App Store, the Apple App Store.
App Store's not bad. I think if we got through to the other side of any sort of regulation, App Store would be really solid.
Would you rather have App Store or Safari?
App Store. Because Chrome already has half market share on Apple devices, or maybe just iPhones, but yeah.
Yeah, but Safari's always going to have some real estate on the iOS user base, right? And it costs $0 to upkeep on Apple's side because Chrome's the default engine. So, I mean, it's what, a $20 billion pure profit check, basically.
Yeah, but the App Store has no competition. And Chrome, like,
true,
takes market share.
Well, we'll see about that. If there is room for a competitive app
regulation. That's what I'm saying, yeah. There's a big, big caveat on that one. I'd say no. For me, it is YouTube. It's, I think, longest runway for growth with a really wide competitive moat. Like, you can look at some of the, obviously Google Search is a great business. AWS is a great business. These are just a little more mature, in my mind. And yeah, YouTube's a small part of Alphabet's overall business, but I think it can grow for 10, 20 years, pretty much unabated.
What about Amazon Seller Services?
Yeah, I mean, that's also quite a large business already. Yeah, it's probably still a large runway to grow, but isn't third-party seller, what is it, like 60% of their business now? So it's essentially betting on their entire e-commerce marketplace.
Yeah, that's true. Amazon Ads?
Yeah.
Once again, it's kind of, these are all like derivative bets off of the overall marketplace.
Yeah. Amazon's e-commerce, it's hard because they're all kind of interconnected.
Yeah. Alphabets are a little more like disparate, if you will. LinkedIn is a pretty impressive business.
What is?
LinkedIn.
Yeah. Sneaky. Sneaky.
It, billion users. It is generating north of $15 billion in revenue now, and that's up like almost four or fivefold from the 2016 acquisition. And obviously there's very low cost to attracting users, just given that you have a billion professionals. Like, obviously there's a network effect there, and it's one of the most powerful places for B2B advertising, would be my guess.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a little higher value, I think, than like asset running an Instagram too. Ad. Yeah.
Not bad.
I like it. Xbox.
Unless they start
rank?
Needing to, unless they start needing to put in AI CapEx. I don't think they do, but if they do, that would come out with some funny quotes. Let's see. We got some questions in the chat here. We also had a lot on the Twitter machine that maybe we can go through as well. And I did look at Adyen, and spoiler alert, it's a European company. They don't follow any sort of reasonable rules. And it looks like they posted some first quarter results, but it's only on a webcast. So looks like we're going to have to wait till next time on that one. But I do have that Chinese real estate one loaded up. Let's see. We have some questions in the chat. Thank you for anyone that joined. Should we already talk Tesla? Question from Tyler, who joins every week. Thank you, Tyler. Why don't you guys own Visa? Great question. On the watch list, and maybe I'm waiting, maybe a little bit too greedy, and I'm waiting for that. Waiting for a better price.
Yeah, I actually have a like page in my notes app on my phone that's just like businesses I want to own at the right price. And Visa's on there. It's probably the first one I wrote down. And it's always obviously the caveat there is at the right price. The thing that when I look at Visa versus the entire opportunity set, the entire world of investments, the only thing I don't like is it's like, where do they reinvest? Like, what, they couldn't turn on the growth engine if they wanted to. Like, if they were like, let's ramp up revenue growth, there's nothing they can really do.
They
just have to buy back.
Yeah, they just return cash to shareholders. It's nice. You can grow without reinvesting that much.
But I would rather have a business where there's a massive reinvestment runway.
Yeah, but I mean, it's even better when you don't have to reinvest and can still grow. Isn't that what the Oracle says out in Omaha?
Yeah, but can't you generate better? Then it becomes your valuation dictates your ability to generate high ROIC. Right? Because if you're putting all the money back into buybacks, what you're buying those shares back at is going to dictate the per share earnings growth, right?
Well, it doesn't change. You mean return investment returns. ROI,
investment too. Returns. Your ROI is coming from it's at the whim of the valuation. But I would rather find one where it can generate higher returns on capital that it's investing back into its business.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly mature business. What's nice is that it's inflation protected.
I did see that they think they still have a massive opportunity, obviously. They think that. But they gave in their conference call,
every
they gave like
that.
Yeah. They did give like three areas that they think they can kind of continue to steal share in, which was ACH and other forms of e-wire transfers, which makes sense. Like if they can start to carve into that with like a Visa bill pay, That would be huge. Cash and check is still quite large. And then what was the last one? A lot of card issuers still rely on domestic networks abroad, and getting them to transition off to a Visa or a MasterCard would be great. But
they're also
I don't see it growing that quickly unless inflation's super high.
Yeah, that's true. They probably grow, you know, GDP plus inflation plus 2-3%, which isn't bad.
They can't increase their take rate though for 5 years after this new resolution. Or no, not until 2030.
They probably shouldn't. That's a regulatory nightmare. They are upselling with analytics, fraud detection, stuff like that. I don't think it's that big of a deal. They like to talk about that a lot on their investment conferences, stuff like that. We have a question here. It says, what PE would you buy Visa and MasterCard at? I'd say maybe in between 20 and 25 times earnings. I know it got to that point a couple of times over the last few years, but I hadn't followed Visa as much. You know, I've only gotten comfortable with owning it recently. So I'd wait for that.
Honestly. I'm a little worried to say what PE I would buy it at because I don't know what PE it trades at. So I'm afraid I'm going to say something where it would like, it's already there. No, I think 20 to 25 times, yeah, I would be comfortable buying Visa and MasterCard.
Yeah.
It's
Tyler says
it is
they are
still one of the best businesses in the world.
Yeah, he says they're trading below that on forward.
Shoot. All right.
I don't have
to go buy.
It's hard. It's more of a... I'm sure he's under... Like, is it under 25 or under 20? Because I'm seeing, like, 33 trailing. I don't know. So
if I were, it would have to be an awesome place to work, Visa or MasterCard, because they are, I remember doing kind of this, just going back and looking at the financials over the last, I think it was like 15 years, and they have had 65% operating margins for 15 years. I bet you every year they're like, all right, we got to find a place to put this. We don't want to get above 70% operating margins. So I guess we're giving huge bonuses out because we don't know what else to do. I guess we'll roll out an advertisement on some random sporting event. Because
yeah. No, that's important. Like those are.
Yeah, but they're selling to the banks.
No, but those are worthwhile advertisements. You need to have customers be aware that Visa is good anywhere in the world.
What customer knows what Visa actually does?
Well, no, they know that it's the Visa card. There's a reason American Express
that merchants accept it.
What? Yeah, they.
But how does that change? But you're not as a customer. You aren't. You're picking whatever your card issuer gives you.
Not my. I mean, I make sure it's Visa. I make sure
you have an
Amex
card.
At least, I make sure I have a Visa or MasterCard at all times because I know that's accepted everywhere.
I mean, if it was some obscure network, I would be like, okay, this might be an issue. But I don't need at this point. Maybe like abroad. Maybe there's certain markets where they don't know the value of Visa being accepted everywhere. But for them to run a Visa ad at a sporting event in America, I think it's pretty pointless. We all know.
I don't think so. I think it's worth it. It's similar to Coca-Cola. Just reinforcing that. It's like the Munger speech. Reinforcing that every year. Widening that moat. I think it's true. Here we have some notes here on the valuation. It's not under 25 times. We got the confirmation here. In between 27 and 28 times forward for Visa. 32.2 on MasterCard. I've never understood why MasterCard gets such a premium. They're not growing that much faster.
Smaller. More upside.
Is that why?
Maybe. Maybe people just look at it like, oh, you know, they both have a huge opportunity. I'll pick MasterCard because they're smaller.
Yeah. I think, with Visa, again, maybe in between 20 and 25 times. I'd think about it, probably closer to 20, just given the growth rate. and the fact that they've already expanded margins so much, and it's probably not gonna, there's not gonna be that much more going forward. But
let's talk about our friends first before we move on here. Let's give.
I was gonna try to lead Gina with a little segue that you know where I put Visa's at one of the top of my watch list, and you know how I track that is our good friends at FinChat.io, Ryan.
Yes, our good friends at FinChat, and they actually just launched a huge update, in my opinion. FinChat V3, the biggest changes here are really around the AI, and I'm going to be totally honest. I have not been a constant user of FinChat AI. I would be lying if I said I was. I just felt like the main value for it was that you could easily find metrics because you could just ask for them, but I thought it was easy to do it with the clicks. Now I have some real value out of it because they've gotten better at qualitative prompts. So if you ask for the one thing I've been doing constantly is summarize company X's conference call, especially earnings season, the companies that I don't follow that closely where I don't want to read the whole thing. It's gotten really good at summarizing those. So I recommend you at least go in, check it out, try it out, and just do that one time. Summarize, you pick your company, summarize their latest conference call, and I think you'll be surprised with the results. You can basically get the outlook, the big headline numbers, the most important KPIs, and management's commentary all in one place very easily. Our link, finchat.io/chitchat. If you're interested in any paid plans, we'll get you 15. That's finchat.io/chitchat. And Brett is showing the Visa charts here. It's a pretty chart. I know. I'm going to be kicking myself in 20 years for not owning Visa. I also want to mention Firm Returns, our friend. It is a financial blog, well, investing blog, I should say, stock research service. And it really is global coverage and a lot of obscure companies. On this show, we can't always talk about obscure companies because we realize that people don't care. But frankly, that's where a lot of the best returns are going to be. And the Firm Returns blog is going to cover a lot of that. Especially, they lean more towards the UK as it's his home market and he has easier access to management in that market. So one of the companies that I've really enjoyed reading about is TinyBuild. It's a little game developer in the UK, and he's had great coverage on that. He gives 4 in-depth research reports on new companies each year. There's no precise schedule to it. And then he's got a bunch of free articles on there as well for his company coverage. It's size agnostic. It'll be, like I said, small companies, large companies. It's really good write-ups, very thorough. And as I mentioned, when he invests on the smaller end of the spectrum, he actually builds relationships with the management teams so he can give you a little bit of hand-holding. If you're a shareholder in these companies and you don't have access to management, you can get some of the conversations that he's had with the executives so that it's a little easier during times of turbulence. He said it served him really well with TinyBuild last year when there was a lot of volatility in the stock. But go ahead and check it out. It's firmreturns.com/chitchat. And you'll get your discount code that Brett's showing it on the screen right now. It's 15% off, I believe. And correct me if I'm wrong there, Brett, 15% off.
Yes. You ask every week, but yes, it is. It's 20% off.
20% off. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what I'm downplaying the discount so people are even more happy when they hear about the 20%. Yeah. Firmreturns.com/chitchat. Go ahead, check it out. At least check out some of the free articles if you're interested. Let's keep talking. Let's hear about China's real estate market because I rely on you for those reports.
Let's see. Let's bring up this article here. I probably don't need to share the screen. Let's start with a quote from the intro here. It's a pretty long form read, so I'm not going to obviously just read the whole thing. But it says a New York hedge fund manager went to a glitzy new apartment complex in northern China, and he wondered how on earth the developer would fill all that space. Quote, it had apartments starting at $1 million and plans for an office tower bigger than the Empire State Building, an opera hall, shopping malls, and hotels. Its total square footage was to exceed the land area of Monaco. Was there a plan for attracting buyers, he asked. Polo, said the marketing agent, showing him around. Polo, you mean the horse thing? Exactly, he recalled saying. So, apparently, this place was founded by a billionaire polo enthusiast, and they started this housing development. This is just an example of what they were trying to do and how big the Chinese real estate bubble got. But think about how large this place was and stuff like that. This was back in 2016. This is just when the bubble was getting started. And these companies, these investment managers, which I think is a lesson, is that a lot of people are shorting these stocks, and it was just at the start of a bubble. So it doesn't look like they made any money or much money, even though they were right. And a lot of these companies went bankrupt. But if we look through what happened here, so here's some more broad stuff for the listeners. This is a quote from the article. More than 50 Chinese developers have defaulted on their international debt. Around 500,000 people have lost their jobs. A private think tank said some 20 million housing units across China have been left unfinished. Again, 20 million housing units. And an estimated $440 billion USD is needed to complete them. Let's see, other stats.
20 million is a lot of housing units.
Yeah, think of
the incentive was just to build. That's like 15 years of new builds in the US.
Yeah, which their population is about four times as large, right? Four times as large. So, still though. Especially when you have all these vacant apartment places, like you don't actually, it's like the opposite.
Okay, if we were If we were just assuming that they have like similar new builds per capita annually, it would be probably around 4 to 5 million new builds every year. I don't know if that's a fair connection to draw.
Yeah.
That means that's 4 years worth of new builds left undeveloped.
Yeah, also
that's a huge amount.
Yeah, and also they basically went and took the great financial or the housing bubble and put it on steroids. So right now they don't need any. And their population is declining, like at a fairly rapid, or it's going to start declining at a very rapid rate. Now, here's some interesting things that happened with this that I think will fascinate any listeners, and especially scare me once again from investing in overseas companies, especially China. So here's a quote. Tulick and Stevenson paid special attention to Evergrande's parking garages. Remember Evergrande? This is the famous one that has gone bankrupt now. Many were nearly empty. By their reckoning, Evergrande had built some 400,000 parking spaces it was struggling to rent or sell. Yet in audited statements, it continued to value the spaces at $7.5 billion or nearly $20,000 per space. Remember, these are audited too by one of the big four. PwC, I think. PricewaterhouseCoopers, I think. And here's what's interesting about it. And this is where I call it a little Enron-y. The developer booked the parking spaces as investment properties rather than inventory assets, an accounting treatment unusual among its peers that allowed Evergrande to overstate their value and book gains early, the two accountants said. I mean, that's exactly what Enron did, right? Remember? From that book? No?
Yeah, I don't
remember
know
when they would
call
book
exactly
the earnings
the
on it when they built it? The stuff?
It was on the new stuff, right? Not the old pipelines.
They would build something and then they would like say, well, we project it's going to make this much money. And then they would go, well, let's just book it all today. And then they're like, well, what's the number? Oh, I made it up.
Of course, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Oh, why wouldn't we do that? And then a bunch of analysts are out there saying the company is insolvent. The auditors are asleep. But the thing is this went on for a long, long time, even through the pandemic. And, you know, back in 2016, 2017. In 2017, home sales rose 11%. And Evergrande's Hong Kong listed shares, do you want to guess how much the stock was up? In that year, 1 year.
In what time frame, sorry? For me, you've been cutting out a little bit, so I don't know if it's being heard, but just in 2017, how much was the stock up? Let's go 50%. I have absolutely no clue.
460%. So pretty tough one to short. Yeah, and then they go through a lot of anecdotes about, you know, Chinese people putting pouring money into real estate. Let's see, it's a long article, so I'm gonna try to figure. There's one other thing on here that I thought was interesting. Let's see. Oh yeah, this one was fun as well. So they would do this thing called and this one is ripe for a scandal, where they say, they call it holding. So I'll just read the quote here. It says, one popular tactic which bankers and investors nicknamed hole digging involved using shell subsidiaries to borrow money guaranteed by the parent, development companies. The guarantee was valid all year long, except, according to documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, for June 30th and December 31st, which were the cutoff days most Chinese property companies used to base their financial results on. So essentially, they were hiding debt off balance sheet. Again, exactly like Enron, right?
Enron-esque, yeah.
I would say that's literally the Enron playbook.
You know what has served me well, honestly, is just the just don't invest in China policy for myself.
It's yeah, and here is what also concerns me, or should I think concern anyone. Now, this is kind of what scared me about the Chinese property market in general, or maybe just the Chinese economy in general. And this is the last quote I'll have. Quote, the total value of Chinese homes and developers' inventory hit $52 trillion, according to Goldman Sachs, twice the size of the U.S. residential market and bigger than the entire U.S. bond market. Chinese people had nearly 78% of their wealth tied up in residential property, compared with 35% in the U.S., according to a report by China Bank, and Southwestern University of Finance and Economics. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's also nice that the Wall Street Journal covers this, because I would probably have no way of discovering most of this myself.
Exactly.
Anyway,
yeah.
Let's talk about our last sponsor for the episode, Public. Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform, Public.com. That is where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. It's paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. NerdWallet overall rating 4.6 out of 5 as of April 2024. Full disclosures are on the podcast description. US members only. I want to do something, Brett. I want to add a new part to the show every week. I think we used to do this too. I can't remember, but every week I want to do an anecdotal evidence. I want to start bringing this back. Something that you saw in the real world that you had some investing takeaway on. It like applies to some public company.
Okay.
Did you have anything? Let's take it from your entire trip that you were gone in Costa Rica and Colombia. Did you have any takeaways, any anecdotal evidence?
If you can invest in the local beer company, it's probably a good bet, because the national beers always seem to dominate each country. It's weird.
Do you remember what it was called in Colombia?
In Colombia, it's called Aguila, spelled A-G-U-I-L-A. I don't know if that's how you officially pronounce it. And then in Costa Rica, it's Imperial. I'm not sure who owns them. They could be owned by someone else. But
interesting.
That's the same in all throughout North and South America, I'd assume. I mean, U.S. is a little different, and yeah, they sell different beers everywhere. But it's interesting that those dominate.
Okay. And you know what? I'm pretty sure Norbert Liu, the episode we did on him, where best investor you've never heard of kind of thing, he made a bunch of money on some investment in, I think it might have been
the it was Argentina, like,
main,
right?
Was it the main beer producer in Argentina?
Yeah, Quilmes, I think.
Quilmes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's an interesting thesis. All right. Latin American beer producers. Yeah,
but the thing is, I think a lot of them, maybe they're not public or something like that. But who knows? Run. Who knows?
My takeaway? I think
those seem really durable to me.
Okay. My anecdotal evidence for the week, I went to Las Vegas and...
Right. For a wedding. That's wild.
I don't know if it's a positive takeaway, but some of the casinos... There was... So... The Wynn is very kind of upscale and very valuable property there. And I saw something about, there was like this quote from, I think his name was Steve Wynn, the original founder. And it was this quote on a conference call that he said that was like, rich people want to be around other rich people to feel good. And that's what we cater to. And it just made me realize that a lot of people will pay just to seem rich. And I think for those luxury casino resorts, that is just kind of an ultimate driver of continued success. The other one, I think if I had to buy a casino property down there, I think MGM would do quite well.
Yeah. And do you remember, we did the show on them. Do you remember what they own now? Because they own more than just MGM. Obviously that one is really good and has all the sporting stuff now, and it's so big.
Yeah, they have like a number of Vegas Strip properties, but they also have a bunch of regionals around the country as well.
Yeah, and I believe they own now essentially all the ones surrounding the one that's actually called MGM, but I forget. We did that episode a little while back, but I can't remember exactly what they all own. These exchange hands a good amount of time, but they seem like good assets to me. I think they own like some of the luxury ones now, like the higher end ones. Could be like the Aria, but
maybe we should revisit. Maybe we should revisit them because
I technically own it still because I own IAC.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think MGM, the online thing could work well too. And just having that entire tie in with like the rewards ecosystem, it makes a lot of sense to me. But
yeah, and they're a consistent repurchaser of stock. Also,
I do have some ethical questions about investing in maybe not the casino properties, like the resorts, because it's also really like hospitality driven as well, but some of the online gambling we talked about it the other week. I worry about the money that's flowing there.
I'm not worried about the ethics. I'm worried about the regulation or any sort of scandal blowback. I mean, what happened? I didn't follow it closely, but didn't an NBA player, and I found his Twitter account, he bet like $3-4 million on NBA games and he just got banned for life. Like these things, there's also that the famous baseball player too.
Yeah, that guy went to high school around the Seattle area.
That's true, he
and one of his close friends bet, I think it was $80,000 on the under for him.
Yeah,
so like betting that he would have less points than was projected, and then he subbed himself out and said he was sick.
Yeah, exactly. That's but
could you be more also, obvious though?
I know, and I can't think of his Twitter handle right now, but he had a Twitter handle that they came out with in the report, and the Twitter handle is just pumping crypto and these penny stocks. It's pretty hilarious.
Oh my gosh.
He was an NBA player, was a crypto day trading. Whatever. Let's see. We got a lot of comments here. Let's see. Well, I asked for some questions on Twitter, so I'm going to maybe name them off until you find one that I think is interesting. Sorry, guys. The comments are too much today. You guys can interact with yourself. Okay. Let's see. First one. What do you two think happens in a higher for longer interest rate regime? If interest rates stay at 5% for the next 10 years, what do you guys think happens to asset/debt-heavy companies, banks and insurance, auto home builders? Pass, or you want to take it?
I think higher for longer is okay, as long as it's for like for banks, home builders, stuff like that, where it's real interest rate sensitive. I think it's okay as long as it's not continuing to accelerate. Like for Ally, I'm just trying to think through this. You can do all right with higher rates, but it's the acceleration in the rates that causes the net interest margin compression, just because the loan book is faster than what they give out to their customers. The loan book is longer dated than what they give out to their customers. Home building, I think you'll have lower home sales over an extended period of time with higher rates, even if it just like prolonged 6% rates or whatever. Like, let's say the mortgage stays at 8%, you're probably not going to get back to your 2021 home sales levels for a long time, but I still think home builders can be okay in that environment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the what's only happened so far.
Affect them. There's immigration, there's migration patterns, family formation, the demographic pyramid, all that stuff. I don't think it's going to be as bad as most people think, except maybe in commercial real estate. And I also don't think it's going to be as like beneficial for some. I think it's just not going to be as impactful as people are assuming. Like, people just put so much energy into this damn Federal Reserve interest rate. I don't care that much. Let's see. Other questions. There was one on Adyen, and unfortunately, they are a European company that doesn't know that you should put out a press release with your numbers. So I'll have to watch that webcast or read it on FinChat later. Let's see. Firm Returns, our sponsor, says JD Sports buying Hibbets. Don't really know about that.
I know a little bit about Hibbets.
Making a bid for Anglo American. Do you know about Hibbets?
I don't know anything about that deal, but I know one of our friends, The Science of Hitting, talked about them on a write-up one time. And it's like it's not very popular up here in the Northwest, but I know throughout like the South, it's a popular shoe retailer. Yeah. And it had done well over the last like 5 years. It had done a decent job growing despite having a big presence in like malls, which I would have thought would just be like a constant outflow or a constant decline in traffic, but they've done all right. And I'm curious. Yeah. I'll read more up on this JD buying them. I don't know what JD Sports is, to be honest. Please tell me that's not like a subsidiary of JD.com.
I don't think so. He asked about a mining acquisition. Sorry. He asked about the FTSE hitting all-time high. I'm sorry. I don't know about that.
Do you think
I don't care about emerging markets, right? For
the United Kingdom. Do you think we overlook European markets too much?
Yeah, because their investor relations teams are... I'm trying not to use a curse word. Not good.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I've seen some pitches for UK companies, and for some reason it just doesn't. Maybe it's I don't know the market, which that's another pitch for going and checking out Firm Returns, who does know the market.
There's got to be a lot of opportunities there. It's cheap.
Yeah, it seems cheap. It's obviously a more mature economy, but
it's safe.
I don't look there enough.
Yeah, it's not like you're investing in, you know, it's not going to have the currency risk of an Egypt or a Turkey. You know,
yeah.
Nothing against those places, but the currencies have been quite volatile. I know we're going a little bit long, but I want to hit all the questions. There's only a couple left, so we can hit them quickly. This one's a fun one. This one got a lot of takes yesterday. 44.6% capital gains tax, Ryan. The question is, would this eliminate some of the allure in growth investing and move people towards income-based investing? I don't know what this means, but also, this is assuming you're going to be making $1 million a year, because isn't the proposal only for people that earn $1 million every year?
I don't know. I honestly...
That's what I saw.
I know we have a lot of international listeners, but there's headlines like this constantly in America about like capital gains rates increasing, and it really hasn't moved a whole lot in like 30 years, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know. Until anything is like solidified, I tend to just ignore it.
True.
Did you read anything about this like proposal?
Yeah, I read that it would be essentially I was like, oh, well, okay, what is that? Like, let's look at who it's going to apply for. And then I read and I was like, well, this would apply to only people that earn $1 million a year. And I was like, oh,
what does okay. it mean to earn $1 million a year? Is that like
income
on capital gains or okay? So people that have income, capital gains is not included.
I think so.
Oh, all right. Well,
but I also could have been. It was a news. You know, it's a news article, so we know that kind of a lot of the news gets like the financial intricacies wrong of all these things. So who knows?
Yeah. Well,
either way, I mean, that affects basically no one.
Yeah, I say. Fade it until anything is solidified. I'd be kind of bummed out if it ever affected me and there was a capital gains tax rate that high. And yes, it would definitely skew me more towards income investing if that was like, if it actually affected me.
Also, I think if you have that much income coming in, I would be spending zero time worrying about taxes. Like, I don't care.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, the reality is most people don't make that much money.
If I have enough wealth that it doesn't matter, I would literally not. Why would I spend my life worrying about that? It sounds dumb. Okay, other one. This one can be quick. Luxury again. Hermes. It's beating everyone. 14% revenue growth.
I kind of don't want to touch luxury right now.
Oh, well, I hope that means that it's going to be a buying opportunity soon.
Did you see that the FTC is suing to block the acquisition or the combination of what was it like Michael Kors and some other luxury brand? And they're like, it might result in raising prices. I'm like, there are like 20 competitors.
Yeah, the FTC, they're going to block everything true luxury right now. Yeah, they're going to try to block everything.
Yeah, anyway.
I don't think it's a surprise.
We've gone a little long. I think this shows
Hermes, once again, is a step above the rest. We have something on selling Ally or Coupang with the temptation to take profits. Not really, no. We're not ones to sell on a 30% pop. That's not really our game. And that is the last one. So thank you for all the questions to everyone. And Ryan, do you want to hit us and close us out with the disclosure?
Sure, I always get this disclosure wrong, but I'll go for it anyways. Thank you all for tuning in. We will see you next week for our Power Hours, which we do every Thursday at 9:30 Pacific time, 12:30 Eastern time, live on YouTube. Anything Brett and I say is not financial advice or a formal recommendation. We may buy, sell, hold securities that are discussed about on this podcast, so don't take it as financial advice. Do your own research, and thank you all for tuning in. See you next time.